You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hello, hello. Tamara here. So good to connect with you again. I want to address something that hinders innovation that you may be doing without realizing. And to do this, I need to share a quick story with you that totally embarrasses myself, but I think you'll get the point. And hey, we're friends, right? So a while back, I'm at the gym on the treadmill, and I'm kind of running along, and I've got my towel, you know, kind of draped over the dashboard. I've got my iPhone there for my music, and I had the wire at the time. It was before I got my AirBuds or AirPods, whatever they're called. And I'm booking it, and I'm listening to some music, and this guy comes in and gets on the treadmill next to me, and he was super cute. So he kind of distracted me, and I'm sitting there and I'm running, and you know, now I want to change my music up. So I've got my iPhone in my hand and I'm trying to change my music, and I'm running fast and I'm trying to smile at the guy at the same time. So I'm doing all these things at once, and you know, I'm playing with my iPhone. I'm changing my music. I'm smiling at this guy. I'm not sure I got anywhere, by the way, but I was smiling at him. And at the same time, I go down to kind of grab the towel to wipe my brow. So I'm trying to do 3-4 things at once. And what happens? The towel drops. I lose my footing and I fly back off the treadmill. Oh my gosh. How embarrassing is that? So embarrassing. The guy, by the way, was very nice and helped me stand up. And then I just went to the locker room and never saw him again. But I share that story not to let you know that I'm a total klutz and am horrible on the treadmill. That's obviously very obvious to everyone. But I share that with you to make the point that multitasking does not work. And that's an extreme example. When I was on the treadmill, I was, you know, trying to smile at the person next to me. I'm playing on my with my music. I'm running. I'm trying to wipe my brow, like doing it all at once. But the same thing happens in work, doesn't it? We are checking emails while we're doing a project, and our text is dinging, and we're also trying to read something, and we're also responding to someone else. I think in an effort to try to get more done, to be productive, we do ourselves a massive disservice by trying to do it all at once. Multitasking does not work. In fact, I recently read a stat that showed that it takes 7 seconds for us to flip from one task to the next. So basically, when we're trying to do 5 tasks at once, even 2 or 3, our brains are constantly jumping and we're creating all these 7-second gaps. So we're not ever really going deep into anything. Multitasking leads to a lack of presence, constant distractions, and definitely a lack of focus. It squelches innovation as your brain is trying to leap between this thing to that thing, and it makes it hard to keep up with everything you're trying to accomplish. So my request for all of us is to stop multitasking. Stop reading emails and listening to a conference call while working on your project. Besides, what you put out when you do this isn't good work. I think you and I both know that. It's okay, but it's not the best it could be. You will actually save more time being fully present and focused, and what you deliver will be more valuable and innovative. So please, why don't you try just for today, stepping away from multitasking. And if you have a lot to do, try chunking, where you do one thing for a half an hour or 30 or 45 minutes, and then you go to the next thing. I'm not saying you have to do one thing all day by any means, but get off the multitasking treadmill. I think what you'll find, like I have, is that you're actually more productive, more innovative. What you generate, what you deliver is better and stronger. Multitasking does not work. Okay. That's my PSA for today. On today's podcast, Jeff Grimshaw has worked with senior leaders for more than 25 years. And along the way, he's helped hundreds of executives in dozens of companies to align people and strategy to produce important business results. He's also the co-author of 2 books and has also published articles in Chief Executive Magazine, Chief Learning Officer, Conference Board Review, etc. I asked Jeff to come on and walk us through his latest book, The Five Frequencies, Leadership Signals That Turn Culture into Competitive Advantage. We're going to dig into this. Some of these will really surprise you. They definitely surprised me. And I think what's cool about them is they help you figure out how to up the culture overall, but also as a leader, how to make sure that all the clues that you're giving out there are working positively and in alignment in a way that's going to move you and your team forward. Okay. Jeff, thank you so much for joining me today. I am very much looking forward to digging into this conversation.
Tamara, thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
So, Jeff, what's your first memory of being innovative?
Well, it's not something that I'm particularly proud of, but I'm just going to tell you, I grew up in a really rural environment, and it was a great hometown, Southern Utah. I grew up in Southern Utah. Great hometown, but a very rural environment. I'll be honest, I was super bored all the time. I was so bored. So it wasn't creating value in terms of innovation, but it was innovation in terms of like, how do I actually keep myself amused? When I was in high school, I was constantly trying to do things to make my very rural life less boring. And so I created an underground school newspaper that ticked off all the faculty and administrators, but it was just like my expression of my problems with authority. And I worked at Kmart in like this soul killing job, because that's like, that was a good job for somebody
Kmart.
In high school. I worked at Kmart, good old Kmart. I was like working in the storage room, and I worked at this Kmart where they made a mistake and ordered like 4 years worth of toilet paper and paper towels at the same time. And so Kmart headquarters sent a semi-truck, a trailer to house all this warehouse, essentially behind the store, all of this toilet paper and paper towels. And I was so bored, and I noticed one day that it had one of those little placards where they can say whether it's like corrosive material or radioactive material. So I thought, this will be interesting. This will like create some interest and intrigue. So I turned the placard on the semi-truck trailer behind the Kmart to say that it was storing radioactive material. Nobody cared. So then I was like, okay, I'm going to call the local paper and say I'm a concerned citizen. So I was able to create some intrigue, some amusement for myself by completely orchestrating some minor drama where the Kmart manager had to go out to the local press and say, no, in fact, we are storing paper towels and toilet paper. We are not housing radioactive material behind this store.
Did they ever find out it was you?
No. Well, they will now, right? I'm confessing for the first time. But, you know, eventually, fortunately, I have found ways to channel some of that need for novelty into something that I can actually make a living with.
Well, that might be one of the most innovative answers I've had. So thank you. And I will say, in asking, I love asking this question because it gives me insight into people and just how they think. And I have found that oftentimes the answer to this question has to do with trying to amuse yourself in really boring times or trying to get out of trouble. So
yeah.
It's a fascinating, like when we look back into our childhood, how creative we are in those two situations when we're bored or in trouble. So I feel like that's a whole different podcast and a different conversation, but
right.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, my pleasure. I wanted
good.
To be honest. I mean, it would have been a cooler story if I could have said, I found a way to make, you know, lots of money for college by doing something innovative. I wish I had had that kind of childhood, but that was the furthest thing from my mind, to be honest.
Oh, and I think that there's many of us out there who listen to that story and go, yeah, I kind of did something like that. So, you know, I love it. So thank you. I want to start a little bit higher level before we kind of dig into your book and the five frequencies and the leadership stuff that you're known for, because your work is really, in the years that you've done, is about aligning people and strategy to produce results. And we're going to talk a little bit about kind of impact and culture today. And I'd love to get your perspective to start off and why culture is so important in today's business environment.
Yeah, I love that question. I think it's more important than ever. I mean, you know, there's the Peter Drucker quote that's been around for a long time, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And if you say that to 100 leaders, 99 out of 100 will agree. Yeah, that's true. but most leaders are actually historically not doing much about that. Or what they're doing as it relates to culture is just stuff that's like being driven out of their HR department. But increasingly, more organizations are actually recognizing that they have to be more serious about culture than they ever have before. And I think it has to do with the digital world and the transformation that the business world is going through, whether leaders want to go through it or not. I think it has to do with the need for speed. I think lots of organizations actually have cultures that have been pretty good. And in fact, this is a lot of the large organizations I work with. They've got cultures that they can be proud of that have served them well thus far in a lot of ways. And they're going, yeah. And, you know, they look and see what's happened in other industries that have been disrupted and by organizations that are more agile, that are more built for speed. And they're going, holy crap. We actually need to do something different about our culture. Way harder to actually do something than to recognize the problem. But obviously, you know, awareness precedes choice and choice precedes change. And so, you know, the starting point is to actually understand that culture is no longer just a theoretical esoteric topic, but it's either going to be, you know, as we move forward into a more, again, you know, digital transformation, things like that, and focused on speed and customer value at every touch point, culture really will either be for any organization an asset or it will be a liability.
So here's my question on that, and bear with me if it comes out a little bit jumbled. Hopefully it makes sense. Do you think in this world, you mentioned digital transformation a few times, and I couldn't agree more. I mean, everything is going tech and AI and digital, and we're working virtually, and technology is kind of how we, in a lot of ways, how we communicate and how we do our jobs. We're on our computers like all day long. I mean, I started working, like really working in 1995. Your computer was something you went to for 30 minutes and then you went and dealt with people, right? It's like, it's a different world, just to date myself a little bit. Do you think that given all of that, that we are actually more desperate or eager for for a connection, and that work is almost becoming our tribes in a lot of ways because we're so disconnected in every other way?
Yeah, that's so funny, because when you asked the first part of your question and I was thinking about the way to respond, I was going to say, I was going to use the word tribe. That, in fact, I think that's 100% true. I think that, you know, there's a lot of research, as you know, from evolutionary psychology and biology that says humans are hardwired for to belong to tribes, and that when we feel like we're part of a tribe, that we can let our guard down. You know, that our primitive ancestors had to be constantly monitoring for threats. So when you were in tribe, you could actually, you know, do a little bit of cerebral thinking about how to, you know, grow or hunt, you know, hunt better or find more food. But when there were other people outside of your tribe around, the theory goes that you were really focused, you were probably operating out of your reptile brain, your defensive mode, right? And so if you fast forward today, where there's a lot of talk about psychological safety, that we know that people don't innovate when they're defensive, that the only environment in which people are going to actually take some informed risk, where they're going to try new things, where they're going to be willing to fail fast, is in an environment where they feel psychologically safe to do so. And if you go back to the, you know, the theory about tribes, that the only way, so if you don't feel like you're part of a tribe, you're not going to be operating from your prefrontal cortex. You're going to be operating out of your reptile brain that's primarily focused on keeping, protecting your ego. And so, yes, tribes, to give you a shorter answer, no matter how much we have in the way of technology, tribal affiliation is desperately, desperately important, or you're going to have a heck of a time fostering a team or a culture that is actually capable of what's required to innovate.
That's super interesting. I'd never really thought about it as like, you know, you go to your tribe, which for a lot of us is work, and that's where you want to feel safe and comfortable and like open to taking risks and being innovative and all that. Because when you're not with them, right, you're in lizard brain and fight or flight. That's a really interesting distinction. So I want to take it inward a little bit. I actually want to start with the negative side for a second before we kind of go into your expertise around how to do it right. I think sometimes it's a little bit like the boiling frog analogy, but I think sometimes we're in a toxic culture and we don't even know it, or maybe we know something's off, but we don't quite know how to articulate it or identify it. Can you share some indicators that a culture is, I don't know, toxic and different, or just working against you or working against the company?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, there's some very predictable answers here, and then I want to move quickly to some answers that might not be obvious. I mean, you know, I mean, in there's like the classical toxic culture kinds of things where people yell and throw stuff, and where there's harassment, and where there is, you know, where people are regularly asked to do things that are go beyond, you know, ethical boundaries. And so, you know, that's obviously classical kinds of stuff that is toxic, and you stay in that very long.
Very obvious,
and it's going to, you know, eat your soul. But I think, especially if you think about it from a perspective of what's an innovative culture, what's a culture that is really geared to maximize speed and delivery of value to customers, there's some things that are still toxic, but I think less obvious. And I'll give you an example that's very top of mind for me. I spent the last 2 days at a large organization. This organization is about 100 years old. It's got about 9,000 employees. And I spent the last 2 days with 40 employees who are about 40 leaders who are about three levels down from the CEO. And this is an organization that is declared for strengthening customer experience and improved innovation. And with these leaders, I asked them two questions. I think these are always two good questions for anybody to think about. And one is, on a 10-point scale, what is your current level of busyness? Like, how much of your capacity are you actually using? And then the second question is, and how productive are you? And, you know, busyness and productivity are different, because we define productivity as actually, you know, doing stuff that actually creates value. And you wouldn't be surprised that most people, when you ask them the question, they'll go, my busyness is like, right now I feel like on a 10-point scale, my busyness is 11. I have never been busier, and it's crazy, and it's just like, I never get a moment's rest. And a lot of people go, no, more realistic. I'm an 8 or 9 on busyness. And then you ask those same people, where are you on productivity? Most people say, I'm at a 4 or 5 on productivity. And then if you ask those people, okay, now what explains the gap? And this is where I'm going to get to the less obvious sources of toxic culture. If you say to these people, as I did over the last two days, tell me about the gap, this big gap, this 4-point or 5-point gap between your productivity and your busyness. There was a lot of answers, but two really stood out to me because I heard them so often. One was, we spend a lot of time on executive whims. So there's somebody in the C-suite who said, hey, don't you think we should be doing X, Y, or Z? In some cases, they might just be thinking out loud, but now a project team has been created and people are working on activities. They're using finite resources, time, energy, dollars. They're using finite resources on things that people on these teams are going, this is so freaking dubious. And aren't we supposed to be about creating more value for customers right now? This ain't doing it. And the second thing that people have said to me over the last 2 days is, we spend a lot of time communicating up. So rightfully, the organization has created new metrics that are closer to the customer. But then instead of relinquishing control over those and decisions to drive those metrics to frontline teams, instead, leaders are saying, okay, now you need to give us really great reports on what's happening with all those metrics. So people are like, I spend 3/4 of my week just creating PowerPoint decks to communicate upward to the organization. So this is an organization that's well-intentioned, and honestly, I believe they're going to get there eventually. But right now, for it's toxic, I think, from at least from a perspective of innovation and customer value, because there's no safe conversation to question the value of what people are focusing their energy on, and leaders are still operating a command and control environment where people, it's motivating people out of fear to have great risk, spend a lot of energy reporting what's happening up the chain of command instead of the chain of command pushing decisions down to the front lines of the organization where they can create more value. And like I said, they'll get there eventually, but right now I'd say that's toxic.
So there are a couple of things I just want to call out for us on Launch Street, because I think they're so important. And one is, you said it in the beginning of this kind of answer, which is that busyness and productivity are not the same thing at all.
Right.
And I find this kind of what you're saying really fascinating about looking into the gap between the two. Is that something you often do? Because that part in itself I found really interesting of like, oh, like I might rate my busyness as a 9, but my productivity is a 3. And that makes me go, well, what the heck? Why?
Yeah.
Like, to your point with this group is managing up a lot, it seems like.
Yeah.
Which is taking a lot of time, and they're not doing at the end of the day. They're just creating PowerPoint decks for meetings that don't do anything. That's me projecting onto them, by the way. I wasn't.
No, it's 100% correct. Yeah.
But there's something really powerful in that gap that you were just talking about that I hope all of us on Launch Street start to really pay attention to. And it'd be very interesting to just start rank ourselves even to say, how busy are we versus how productive are we and our team as well?
Yeah, it can be sobering, but then a lot of times, you know, it's good to actually have the answer and then confront and explore that gap and then do something about it.
Do you find that a lot of times the things that make it toxic or even just ineffective are things that we all kind of know in the back of our minds but aren't addressing? Or do you find that there are things that we didn't even realize were the case until we really dug in?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, no one has ever accused us of being rocket scientists. No one has ever said, oh my gosh, what you are sharing with us is a profound revelation. I think a nice way of saying what we bring to the table is like enlightened common sense, you know, but when we're talking to organizations about what it actually takes to shift their culture, you know, it's just so simple that people go, yeah, no, I sort of intuitively understood that all along. And then the next question is then, why aren't you doing it? And then how do we help you do that?
Don't you think though that, I mean, it almost should be a head nod and a validation, right? Like I don't know, to me, it seems like it almost should be. But the other thing I'd say is, I think there's something really powerful in having someone from the outside be able to kind of crystallize and frankly give a safe place to talk about these things so that it doesn't become a you versus them or a him versus her or whatever, because you're there to facilitate in a way that makes it productive.
Yep. Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's, you know, I mean, that's honestly, you know, I talked about creating, amusement for myself as a teenager and then trying to figure out how to monetize that. And honestly, I feel like I've got the best job in the world is that I love challenges. I love new challenges. I love people. And so instead of like, you know, creating mischief in the back of behind a Kmart, I love actually helping people who are already really smart, but are so darn busy with like all the stuff that they're actually trying to do in addition to shifting culture, to help, you know, come in and provide some, expand their sort of cognitive bandwidth to help them figure out how to prioritize and how to focus those efforts and how to do it so that they actually do turn their culture into a source of competitive advantage.
So let's talk then about how to do it right. So you wrote this book, I think it's fantastic, it's based on all this experience, which is 5 frequencies, leadership signals that turn culture into competitive advantage. And of course, we'll put the link in the show notes. but I would love to spend some time digging into those five frequencies. So can you lay out each of them for us? And I'd love to dig in a little bit on each of them, I'm sure, and how they make an impact.
Yeah, great. Yeah. So what we found through about a quarter century of research is that leaders shape culture, intentionally or not, with the signals that they transmit on what we call five frequencies. First is you're creating culture, again, whether you intend to or not, through your decisions and actions. Second is through what you reward and recognize. Third is through what you tolerate or don't tolerate. The fourth frequency is how you show up informally, you know, in unscripted settings when you're not, you know, using PowerPoint, but just when you're with people in actual honest-to-goodness conversation. And then the fifth frequency is formal communication. Formal communication is not unimportant, but it's usually the least important. Lots of times organizations think they're going to change their culture by just having killer formal communications, you know, new buttons, banners, videos, stuff like that. But if it's divorced from the signals that leaders are broadcasting on the other four frequencies, they'll either ignore it or, you know, make fun of whatever your organization is doing through its formal communications.
So I love these. I'd love to ask. I just have a kind of a one or two questions about each of them, if that's okay.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I'm just going to start at the top and kind of work my way down. So decisions and action. So as a leader of a company and as a parent, it kind of intuitively makes sense to me. Like, you know, my team mimics what I do, or what I do kind of sets the tone. But you do say it's more showing than telling. What experiences have you had around that in terms of that balance between showing and telling?
Yeah, I think one example that springs to mind is a hospital CEO that we work with is named Reggie Eady, and he's a great leader. And I spent time with him. He worked in an organization, a hospital that's just under just constant pressure. Actually, I'm in Detroit today, and this hospital is in downtown Detroit. It's not actually the company I'm talking about. It's a different company in Detroit. And this hospital, they are really working on continuous improvement. And Reggie has done a great job of preaching continuous improvement and giving people the tools to do it. But one day when I was accompanying him as he was going around and having teams show what their metrics were and what they were doing to improve their metrics, he rightfully, this is in a hematology ward, and he rightfully said to them, hey, here's all the other good things that you've done. But then he hopped up on the bed. He hopped up on the bed in the hematology ward, and he looked at the ceiling and he said, okay, now what do you all see? And they looked up at the ceiling, and everybody could see that there was in the corner, there was a broken ceiling tile. And he said to them, so what do you think we need to do? And they're like, well, we need to fix that. And he said, why do you need to fix it? And they said, because that's what the patient sees when they're laying in this bed having blood transfusions. And he was like, exactly. So to me, that's the difference between somebody who does great things in terms of, you know, getting out there and being with the people and reviewing their metrics, and then being the guy who jumps on the bed or does something else that really takes them a step further to see things from the customer perspective, from the patient perspective. In this case, I think that's the difference between a really good culture and a great culture that truly is a sustainable source of competitive advantage.
So I love this one. And I'd say, you know, in my world in innovation, I see a lot of leaders that talk a lot about how important it is. We got to be innovative. We got to think differently. We got to change with the times. But the minute their team goes to them, they shut it down because they're not really ready to be innovative. They're not really ready to make the changes they need to make. So they can they tell it a lot, but they don't do it. I don't know if that's kind of what you mean here, but tell me, is that what you mean here? Because I see a lot of that too.
Yeah.
Talk, but when the rubber meets the road, right, they don't actually allow for it to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like another, because again, the whole goal was, it's easy for a hospital CEO to say we've got to see things from a patient's perspective. But some of the other things that Dr. Edie did was, again, just literally seeing things from a patient perspective, like role modeling the behavior he wanted to see more of, is that he and others, leaders, were pushed around in gurneys and in wheelchairs. And part of it was, okay, now how are we going to get a perspective? We only tend to see what our service and care delivery looks like from our perspective. If we're really going to deliver the greatest value possible to our patients, we've got to see what it looks like from their perspective. And so, again, it's symbolic action, but it is action that really, in a memorable way, says to people who are wondering whether this is flavor of the month or something they should take seriously, dang, Dr. Edie really does care about looking at things from a patient's perspective.
That's a great example. So the second one is what they reward and recognize. I get all geeked out about this one because I think, to say it nicely, there's a lot of room for improvement in terms of reward and recognize. So talk more about this one.
Yeah, you know, a lot of reward systems in organizations classically are not necessarily aligned with what actually creates the most value. So, for example, in some organizations, people who, when a crisis happens, when there's firefighting required, organizations often do a great job of making heroes and creating rewards for people who, you know, step into the breach when that's required. And a lot of these organizations go, yeah, but I wish we actually solved or prevented a lot of these challenges before they actually turned into crises. And then if you go, okay, but what are your rewards for people who are quietly working behind the scenes in non-sexy situations, you know, trying to prevent problems from happening? They'll scratch their heads and they'll go, I guess we never actually do reward and recognize that stuff. So in a lot of cases, organizations need to think about what are the behaviors you want to see more of, and then take a look at what they are actually what they are currently rewarding and recognizing, and a lot of times finding that there's a gap between those two things and then closing that gap. I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
We're working in one large organization, global pharmaceutical company, one of these large organizations that is declared for, you know, we're going to transform, we're going to adopt agile ways of working at an enterprise level.
Yes, I hear that
a lot.
So that
we can pick up our speed. And so what they need to do, you know, what's the behavior they want to see more of? Some of the behaviors they want to see more of are people actually feeling like they're genuinely empowered and taking action, making decisions. They need people to fail fast. They need people to take some risk and innovate and try new things. And no stigma associated with making mistakes. There's only stigma associated with not learning from mistakes. But these are shifts, right? And they're old ways of rewarding and recognizing, giving warm signals, reinforcing warm signals to people needed to get caught up with this new culture that they had declared for. So some of the things that they're doing is leaders are, you know, really being conscientious about when employees do make decisions and take action, even if they weren't sure that leaders really were serious about saying you're empowered to make decisions and take action, they're making sure that they get reward signals. They're making sure that they get reinforcing warm signals like, that's great, that's awesome, I'm going to tell other people about what you're doing. That's a great story that other people should know about. They are rewarding experiments and the learning that's extracted from them, even when the experiments fail to produce the hoped for results. That's a huge, huge shift for a lot of organizations where the only experiments, if they ever existed, were the things that turned out fabulously.
Yeah, I think
that's a shift.
Yeah, I think, you know, kind of to what you're saying is we reward outcomes, not behaviors.
Yeah.
And those behaviors are successes or failures, but they're after the fact, they're lagging at the end of the day. And kind of to your point in the very beginning of this conversation, like we reward people for, you know, going into battle, but we don't reward the people who are back there trying to keep the battle from happening. And those behaviors that we ultimately, right, I think want more of, the outcomes are going to happen no matter what. I mean, is that kind of what you're saying? Like, let's take a step back for the behaviors we want, not just the outcomes we want.
Exactly. Exactly. That, you know, because we say, you know, how do you define desired state culture? We work carefully with leadership teams to measurably define their desired state culture. And we do that by saying, okay, in the culture that's going to give you a source of competitive advantage, you know, 1 year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, whatever the time horizon they care about. In the culture that gives you a source of competitive advantage, what does everybody in the organization know and understand? What do they feel or believe? You know, what's like going on in their hearts? What's going on with them attitudinally? And then ultimately, it's the behaviors. What do you want people to do? And so these are the leading indicators that we think are predictive of the lagging indicators that they're the actual outcomes. So the simpler answer to your question is yes, absolutely. It is about getting really clear about what do we want people to know, what do we want people to feel, what do we want people to do, with the belief that these are the things that are ultimately going to, if people are doing these things consistently, it's going to give us the outcomes long-term that we care about.
Yeah, I really appreciate this is one of your five frequencies, because I think that if you really thought, if leaders, those of us in leadership, really thought deeply about what are the behaviors we want more of, it's pretty easy to come up with a very thoughtful and value-aligned list that, to your point, gets us to where we want to go, versus kind of hoping those things happen and then rewarding along the way.
Exactly.
I'm super excited for the third one, because this is where I think a lot of crossed wires happen. Mm-hmm. And this is what they tolerate, or as you put, or don't tolerate.
Yeah. So a couple of things there. You know, when it comes to innovation and speed and agility and those kinds of things, some of the things that people need to tolerate, there's what you need to start tolerating that maybe you didn't before. So, you know, one of the things that we talk about is the mantra that mistakes are expected, inspected, and corrected. Mm. So if you want people to really focus on treating mistakes as intellectual capital and extracting learning from them, then what you do need to tolerate is some mistakes, some like non-negligent right. mistakes. I mean, if people are doing just stupid stuff repeatedly, then you don't want to tolerate that. Right. But assume people are going to make mistakes. They're expected, inspected, and corrected. You got to start tolerating that, because otherwise you create a motivation for people to hide their mistakes instead of learning from them. And that right. It's right. costly to organizations, sucks value out of the organization. On the other hand, the other thing we say is leaders are defined by what they tolerate. And this is one of the ones where when we get feedback data from for leaders, this is the one that is often the weakest of the five frequencies for a lot of leaders,
yeah.
where they rationalize a lot of things. They tolerate stuff that when they're pressed, they know that they shouldn't, either because they don't want to have tough conversations, they get uncomfortable holding people accountable, or they don't know what they're going to do if they hold this person accountable. They're fearful that maybe they're going to leave. One of the things that's like really toxic is when, and this happens a ton, is when leaders, because they don't want to hold low performers accountable, they just give more work
yeah.
to their high performers.
It's like the A player.
Yeah. The award for winning the pie eating contest is more pie.
Right.
You
yeah.
know, which is at some point those top performers are going to go, okay, well, maybe I want to head somewhere else, because I'd actually like to be getting different kinds of rewards than this for my high performance.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I will tell you, and I don't mean this in an ego way, but I used to be that A performer with two other, I don't know, C-minus performers at best around me. And I used to get so frustrated, because all it meant was more work for me. Like, oh my gosh, Tamara, thank you so much for getting that done so well so soon. Here's another project. I was always like, this is not fair. It used to make me so angry, and it made me not want to do my best.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is that for a lot of leaders, it's like, but they keep doing it because it helps them get through the day. But if you go, okay, but think about, is this still going to be paying off for you? If you think about, 3 months or a 6 month basis or a year basis, and they go, no, this is going to come back and bite me in the butt. And that's one of the things that we go, you know, one of the things that we say to be provocative to leaders is be long-term greedy. Because a lot of the things that leaders do that hurt their cultures are things that help them get through the day or the week or the quarter, but they're things that hurt their culture in the long run. And a lot of times, a lot of our work is really just about getting people to evaluate the cost-benefit analysis on their own leadership behaviors from a longer-term time horizon. Like, what's the return on investment for your leadership behaviors if you think 18 months out or 5 years out? And if you put it in that perspective, people go, okay, well, there's a lot of things that I'm actually doing right now that I think are very costly to me. And then we go, okay, well, then let's help you actually make more rational leadership choices.
I really appreciate, and I just wrote down about, am I doing this to get through the day? What a great gauge on your leadership decisions and what you're allowing and tolerating or not. And, you know, I think on the flip side to that is sometimes A performers get to behave badly because they're the top of the game. Like, we had one on our on another team that was always late to every meeting. They were so disrespectful, but they got away with it because they brought in the most money. But it actually had a huge toxic effect on the entire team. But I wanna actually loop back and ask you about, you had said kind of in passing, but I think it's really important, about it's hard to hold people accountable, or sometimes, you know, that accountability factor that you have to do as a leader can be difficult. What advice do you have for those of us who are sitting back here? I'm listening to this and I'm going, yeah, you're right. I got to really think about this long-term greedy, but that means some accountability. So what advice do you have for me to help me get better at that? Because I actually think that's easier said than done.
Yeah. Well, one thing is just to step back and have the awareness about what your failure to confront the bad behavior is costing you. Mm-hmm. And so when you recognize the cost, that can be a motivator to act. I'd say the other thing that goes along with that is, like, a lot of times I've heard leaders go, well, I'd like to hold people accountable more than I do now, but I don't want to create waves. You know, it's going to create some drama in the organization. And then if you can finally get those leaders to actually do something, the rest of the organization is going, like, thank goodness, it's about time. So instead of creating more drama in the organization, it was like, well, you finally done what was so obvious to so many of us for so flipping long. And so I think some of it is just about having a perspective. I think the other thing is that's useful is to rehearse what you're going to say in a tough conversation with a trusted advisor. Mm. I've worked with a lot of leaders who, absent a rehearsal of what they're going to say, they go, you know, Jeff, I really had this stern conversation with somebody, and I'll go, well, tell me what you said. Are you sure that came across? And it becomes very clear later that this stern conversation, you know, because it was couched in, well, I have some positive feedback for you before I get to the negative feedback.
The sandwich.
The negative feedback was never heard. The message didn't come through. And so, you know, it's just, there are techniques for doing this, but honestly, I think, you know, get somebody and rehearse. But also my advice, to be honest, to people who find this difficult to have tough conversations is the tough love advice to go, okay, well, you're a leader. This is why you get paid the big bucks, presumably. So, you know, suck it up and have the conversation. You are defined by what you tolerate. You got to put markers out there. Like, let me say tomorrow, like, one of the things I thought was really cool when we scheduled this podcast interview is it was communicated to me that, hey, you know what? If this podcast isn't interesting, I reserve the right to shelve it. And I was like, you know what? I've done a lot of podcasts to promote this book, and no one has ever said that before. And I thought that was awesome because was I already motivated to bring my A game? I'd like to think so. But when I saw that, was I like, you know, I've been facilitating for 8 hours today already, and that used up a few brain cells. But I saw that, and I was like, I am not going to be the person whose podcast gets shelved. I am going to actually try to have this be a useful podcast, and hopefully it will be. I'm not taking it for granted that this is going to make the cut, but I just think, like, you putting that marker out there and saying, I'm not going to tolerate, so I'm not going to put out to my audience something that is not interesting. Like, more people should be doing that. I really appreciated that.
Well, thank you, Joe. I appreciate that, that you even noticed that. So thank you. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that as an example. And so far, we're good. I think we're going to air this one. We're
okay.
It's all actually right. Fantastic.
I'm not going to coast from here on now, though. I'm going to,
it's all downhill from here.
I take nothing for granted. Yeah.
Right. Well, what's interesting is, you know, that email, some of our other emails, you know, to your point, were very like, if you're one of the other things that we were tolerating in the past, was people would show up, but their tech would be a mess. So then we spend 10 minutes with me trying to coach them through how to use their headphones or whatever. And I'm not a tech person, number one. And number two, I don't have 10 minutes to spend doing that. And if you can't
right.
spend 10 minutes figuring that out on your own, you're probably not ready to do a podcast of our size anyway. But I will tell you what's interesting about that is I had a whole debate with my team. They were like, well, you got to be nice to people. We need these people on our show. We need great guests. You don't want to be too mean. And I really had to push back because I don't want to tolerate those things. And I will say that I was nervous about it. I was worried it would turn people off. So I'm really glad to hear your feedback on that. But what I found is that we're getting better guests showing up more prepared and for more interesting conversation because they know we mean business when they show up. And we mean it. So if someone's 15 minutes late, I cancel the interview, period.
Right.
So,
right.
Like, and it happens every now and again. It's not that I won't reschedule if someone's like, my God, I had a flat tire, my dog's in the hospital,
right.
You know, like it happens. But kind of to your point, we really had to put our foot down and say, here's what we are willing to tolerate. So I appreciate that someone noticed. Thank you.
I'm just one person, but my guest satisfaction went up, not down, when you put out the marker that we have high standards and we're not going to tolerate anything that falls beneath our standards. Sure.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And for Launch Street out there, just know that kind of, Jeff, what you're saying, Jeff, about like, look, suck it up, right? That's your job. And it's nerve wracking, but it's what everybody else wanted you to do to begin with. So just do it. It doesn't create more drama is, in my experience, has been 100% too. So that is a great frequency. To go to number four, and this one surprised me a little bit because I don't know that I ever gave this part thought about how you show up informally.
Yeah, it is important how what you do on this frequency goes makes a big difference in terms of what we talked about earlier, whether people feel like they're part of a tribe or not. But how you show up informally, first of all, it just starts with showing up. You know,
right.
You probably are not going to have a good culture that is a source of competitive advantage if you're not actually spending time with people in sort of a servant leadership mode, helping them figure out, solve problems and find ways to create more value. The second thing that I'll say that is really a big deal when it comes to how you show up is it's an opportunity to change the conversation. You know, everything that happens in an organization happens in or because of a conversation. And so if you want to change the culture, you got to change the conversation. So one of the things that we're big on, you know, it's just words, but we're really big on some mantras and we really try to find ways to help leaders get out into the organization and not only say these mantras, but live these mantras. And some of them are things like you've heard me say them earlier, mistakes are intellectual capital, that mistakes are expected, inspected, and corrected, or we reserve the right to get smarter, you know what is, if you're focused on if you're willing to give it a shot, then I'm willing to back you, or, hey, you know, that's good enough. Let's try that and then iterate. Or, hey, even if this doesn't work out, we're going to learn from trying, or I trust your decision. Like the more that leaders are saying these things in organizations and of course, meaning them in their informal communication, then you will see the culture change, that you will see yourself creating that environment, that environment of psychological safety where people spend less time defending their egos and instead investing more energy into figuring out cool, new, faster ways to create more value for customers.
I really like that focus on informal. I think those of us on Launch Street really need to think about the conversations that we're creating. And I love that phrase you just said about, you want to change the culture, you have to change the conversation. And, you know, I think you said this earlier, we spend a lot of time on, which is number five, the formal communication, but then we kind of slack on the informal. And I don't know, have you found that like when we slack on the informal, we're actually then sending mixed messages because we tend to not show up with the right frequency?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then what happens is, you know, when you do put out the posters or the videos, either people will just go, well, that's meaningless, or they will make fun of you because they'll go, ha, 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 that's, you know, that's clearly not what you actually care about because of the signals that they've been watching you broadcast on the other four frequencies.
You know, it was interesting. I had a colleague of mine telling me, they work in a large company, and they were telling me about their boss, and they said, they didn't do something right. They had a mistake. And their boss said, you know, we'll call him Greg. Greg, it's really unfortunate you made that mistake. I spend a lot of time investing in my team and trying to help you, you know, learn the skills you need to do your job. And what Greg said to me was, you know, Tamara, it took everything in my power not to roll my eyes in that conversation because I've never seen him once invest anything. I don't even have a budget to go to a leadership program. So like, you know, that informal conversation, which I'm sure the guy was trying to do his best, but it wasn't backed up by the other frequencies at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's just so key. You are transmitting these signals all the time. People are paying attention to them. And if you don't, and if you are sending different signals on the five frequencies and you don't know it, you're in trouble because guarantee you the people around you are noticing that.
Yes. And they're noticing it a lot more than they're telling you, right? I mean, my friend said he didn't say anything in the meeting besides, I'm sorry, I made the mistake, but he walked away with like, are you kidding me? Like, really?
Right.
I want to ask about the last one, the formal communication. You kind of were talking about like that one's kind of obvious. We know that, right? Like we put out really nice newsletters and town hall meetings and whatever. But one of the things you talk about is that you can use formal communication to amplify your signals on the other frequencies. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I just think it's a great opportunity first of all, to make folk heroes out of people. So, you know, in a lot of organizations, historically, formal communication channels have been used to, even if this wasn't really the intention, they're sort of narcissistic. They glorify the senior leaders. But I think one of the things that makes formal communications way more relevant is if finding the stories of people, individuals and teams that are engaging in the behaviors that you want to see more of, and using your formal communication channels first and foremost as an opportunity to turn those folks into folk heroes. People like that. People like that content. And it becomes a reward, a frequency too. It becomes a reward for the people who have gotten out there and done the things that you've been asking people to do in the culture that you're trying to create.
So I want to, you kind of alluded to a minute ago, but now that we've talked about all five, I want to go back to this for a second and kind of wrap them all together because they're all important in different ways. And I see that by what you're saying. How do you think about the mix of them and making sure that you're in alignment across all of them? And we were kind of telling some case studies earlier, which really I thought kind of highlighted that, you know, they had some down but not others, and they were actually working against each other because of that. When you work with clients, how do you help them get that mix right?
Okay. So what we try to do is focus on gaps between current and desired state culture. And then, you know, I wish I could describe this. And in fact, I'm going to send you something that if you want, you can use it in the show notes. It's a fishbone diagram that we use.
Oh, I'd love to.
And so, you know, typically in the head of a fish, it's the outcome that we're trying to create. And so let's say we're in an organization where part of the culture that leaders want to have is an organization where employees actually do make decisions. They do try to do things and then learn fast from whatever happens, right? Mm-hmm. And let's say we go, okay, well, that's what we want, but That's not what we have. So there's a gap there. So if we put at the head of the fish, the outcome we're trying to create, okay, employees are twice as likely as they are now to actually take initiative, take action, fail fast, innovate, try new things, whatever it is that we want them to do. We want them to do that twice as much as they're doing it now. Then in the fishbone diagram, we work our way around each of the five frequencies and we go, what could we do here? What's like the simplest way, what's the simplest thing that we could do in each of these frequencies that is going to help us achieve this outcome? And then, you know, like with everything else in life, you've got to prioritize. But the idea is, if we do these things, is it going to actually create the lift that we're looking for? And if it doesn't, then, you know, how do we rearrange what we've got in the five frequencies? I will tell you that in a lot of cases, organizations don't actually fill in all five frequencies. Often they do, but in some cases, they go, okay, well, what we're rewarding is actually pretty good now, or we don't need to do anything different in our formal communication. But looking at it from a fishbone perspective helps you get really clear on how do we take a coherent and integrated approach from moving from the culture we have to the culture we need, focused on something very specific, from the culture we have to the culture we need in support of competitive advantage. And then I think if you put this in the show notes, people who are curious but go, I don't really know what the heck he was talking about. As soon as, you know, picture's worth a thousand words, as soon as you look at it, you go, okay, I think I can understand pretty quickly how we could use this tool.
So how do you think getting your five frequencies right or in alignment helps you build a culture that fosters more innovation across the business?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with just so many things in organizations, in large organizations, and organizations that have been successful up until this point are just not the things that are conducive to innovation. That, you know, what lots of organizations have rewarded frequency two in the past is engineering things to perfection. And that's not always trait that's
opposite of
most innovative.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What organizations have not tolerated is making any mistakes.
Yeah.
And so what it has done or failing with anything. And so it's just created, you know, so if organizations can harness the energy that people put every day into minimizing and rationalizing and spinning mistakes and sweeping them under the rug. And if they could harness half of that energy and put that and refocus, rechannel that energy into innovation, my goodness, I mean, the value that can come out of that could really be a source of competitive advantage. And so not to distill it or oversimplify it, but just those two things, I think, are a lot of what it means to what's required for a lot of organizations in 2019, 2020 to reshape culture for greater innovation,
you know,
and therefore greater competitive advantage.
Yeah, no, I think that's very well said. And to loop it back to your example, the beginning with the busyness versus productive and the two things that came out about they're spending their time at the executive whims and communicating up. Like, just imagine as you're working through with them, this team, once they get an alignment on the five frequencies and stop doing that, how innovative and productive they'll be in the future.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Like, those are two great things to get rid of in so many ways. That was very helpful. And I'm looking forward to the fishbone. I would love to add that. I think what a great idea. And I think I hear you say is be very clear and specific in the head of the fish. Building
yep.
a culture of innovation, getting a more cohesive team, whatever it is that you're trying to get towards, right? Like, be clear and then work through the bones.
Right. Don't just say, well, we want people to be more innovative. Like, describe the specific behavior that you're
okay.
looking for.
Got it. Oh my God, this is so good. All right. So before we have to close, where can people go to learn more and connect?
Our book website is fivefrequencies.com. And you can either spell it out, F-I-V-E frequencies, or just the numeral five. And at our website, you can download the book's introduction for free.
Oh, great.
And then there's links to buy it. And for a lot of book clubs are using it. And so there's a discussion guide. So there's multiple things that you can get there. And then on Twitter, we're at numeral five frequencies.
Awesome. And all those links in our show notes. Jeff, this is one of the best books I've read in the last year. I read a lot of books for the podcast, as you can imagine. And this was, I just have to say, this was one of the few that I felt like gave me a very clear direction and some new insight into how to think about building a culture beyond the kind of very general platitudes, which actually drive me crazy because it's horrible to say, but those to me seem to come from people who've never actually done it, mm-hmm. who aren't in the trenches. And to me, this particularly with these five frequencies that you laid out, which are so critical, are things that are actually in the trenches that you can actually do and start to see results on, which I'm sure you do with the teams you work on every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you. That means so much to me. And I also want to share something with you, which is I'm so glad that you scheduled me for this. You know, if I hadn't been on your podcast, I wouldn't have known about your instrument, your innovation quotient edge, which I took. And so what I learned was that in terms of my power trigger, I'm a risk taker and I'm imaginative. And that was like, that's you know, and not surprising. It was sort of like confirming what I know. But on But what was really, I think, important for me is, you know, one of the things I think is important for the leaders that we work with is it's got to be important for us too, which is sometimes you got to, you know, change your success formula. You know, what got you here isn't going to get you there. And so my dormant trigger is collaborative. And I mean, that sort of was intuitive to me, but getting these results sort of forced me to confront that. And I think like with my clients, if I don't do something about that, it's going to cost me. We always have to maintain competitive advantage, like the large organizations we work with. And so this has been great for me very selfishly because I'm going to be working with my team over the next week trying to find some ways for me to up my collaborative.
I love it. So Jeff, I'll just tell you really quickly that maybe this is why we get along so well. And I mean, we just met on this podcast, but I'm a risk taker experiential. So we have one power trigger in common and my dormant is also collaborative.
Wow.
And it actually drove me a little bit batty when I first found out because I thought, I like people. Hold on. I built this assessment. I should just be good at everything. Right. So, but I'm not. And it turns out because just for those listening who don't have collaborative as a dormant, that means that, so people who are collaborative as a power trigger pull disparate people and ideas and experiences, like they pull it all together to innovate. It kind of like all these dots coming together like to a magnet. Where people like us, it's not that we're not open to feedback and we love relationships, but it's not how we innovate. We tend to form ideas first and then put them out into the world. And to your point, sometimes it's in our best interest to take a step back and maybe be a little bit more open on the front end too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I got to work on that. Yeah. I didn't see your results come in, so I didn't realize you had taken them, but thank you for sharing that. So my last question to you is, what advice do you have for us innovators on Launch Street to begin closing that gap between the culture we have, as you say, and the culture we want?
Well, you know, like I said, nothing that we do is rocket science. I mean, anybody with any team anywhere can use our two methods. And the first one is defining the culture that gives you a source of competitive advantage. Mm-hmm. In the culture that, you know, think about it, in the culture that gives you a source of competitive advantage, what is it that people consistently know and feel and do?
Yeah.
And remember that feel is F-E-E-L. Like I said, I grew up in Utah. So a lot of times when I say feel, people think I'm saying the word, the name feel, P-H-I-L. And growing up in Southern Utah, they're pronounced the same way. So what do you need people to know and feel and do? And don't come up with 150 answers, or do come up with 150 answers, but really pare it down to 12 or less.
Yeah.
That's your desired state culture. And then say, okay, based on all the data available to me, what are the biggest gaps? And then grab the fishbone diagram and go, okay, what am I going to do around the five frequencies? my decisions and actions, what I reward and recognize, what I tolerate or don't, how I show up in formally and formal communication. What's my leadership experiment? What am I going to try? Not forever, but for like, you know, 6 weeks or 3 months. What am I going to try to close some of these gaps between the culture that I have and the culture I need? Like, treat it like it's science.
So, Jeff, I think that's really interesting advice. And we could probably do a whole podcast on how you determine the culture that gives you a competitive advantage. And I know that's in your book and in the work that you do. And I love the idea of really focusing on one thing and making that your advantage. And not trying to be everything to all people, because I think, like, you know, we think about that in marketing a lot, about like, don't be everything to everybody, but we don't think about it in terms of our culture too, that like, hey, you got to put a stake in the ground for your culture and decide what you want to be there too.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, a lot of the organizations we're working in are trying to be more agile. And so we say, why don't you apply agile principles to the way that you're trying to shift your culture in support of having this whole thing work? And so it really is about, you know, not trying to do everything and not trying to do it perfect, but pick something and then try an experiment and learn from it as quickly as you can, double down on what's working and recalibrate what isn't. That's a good set of principles to operate from, whether it's business process and what you actually do for your business and executing on your strategy, or whether it's simply about how you're shifting your culture so that your culture doesn't eat your strategy for breakfast.
Yes, exactly. Well said, and a great place to leave it on. So Jeff, thank you so much for joining me. And for Launch Street, when this podcast airs and we have the fishbone, everything in the book, go get those resources because they're absolutely fantastic. So thank you.
Thanks, Tamara.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.